Welcome to Addiction and the Family, Episode 51, A Therapist Finds Recovery. How has addiction affected your family?
It robbed me of my father.
Addiction's affected my family in absolutely every way.
It has caused a lot of turmoil.
It goes back to what I understand is at least three generations.
It robbed my daughter of her mother. It robbed my mother of her daughter.
Addiction has made our family quite challenging.
Addiction affected my family tremendously.
It's affected my relationship with my sister, where I'd go for months without talking to her.
It's a very difficult thing for everybody involved. It doesn't just affect the one individual. It's a disease that affects the whole family.
Addiction has spread not only genetically through some of my relatives and I assume ancestors.
It's generational.
I think of him every day.
Welcome to Addiction in the Family, a podcast by and for family members of anyone with an addiction. My name is Casey Arriaga, and I'm a clinical social worker and addiction counselor at both Windmill Wellness Ranch and In Mind Out Emotional Wellness Center. And I'm the author of the books, Realistic Hope, The Family Survival Guide for Facing Alcoholism and Other Addictions, Spirituality for People Who Hate Spirituality, and the new children's book, Mommy's Getting Sober. My wife, Kira, and I were in our addictions for over 10 years together in a shared recovery for over twice that long. Join us as we offer experience, strength, and realistic hope about how you and your family can find recovery together. In this episode, we talk with Mia Tracy, a clinical social worker, about her recovery journey, how it has impacted her family and her work as a therapist, and what she would offer to anyone else who may be facing their own internal resistance to embracing recovery. All this and more after a break to hear from one of our sponsors. Addiction in the Family is brought to you in part by the generous support of Windmill Wellness Ranch, an innovative treatment center located in the beautiful hill country of Texas and serving clients and their families from throughout the United States.
I'm Shannon Mollish, CEO of Windmill Wellness Ranch. We offer the best in neurotechnology to heal the brain and the best therapy to heal the mind. Call us today at 210-762-6217.
I'd also like to let you know that Windmill Wellness Ranch now has a free course available to any family or friends of anybody with any addiction. The course is available at windmillfamilycourse.com. Once you go and sign up for free, you'll get a weekly email pointing you towards blog posts, videos, and podcast episodes that help carry a message of hope. Sign up today at windmillfamilycourse.com. Welcome back. Without further ado, let's get into our interview. Welcome. If you want to take just a moment and introduce yourself and tell us, what are you doing on a show called Addiction and the Family?
My name is Mia Tracy, and I own a private practice in Dripping Springs. The practice name is In Mind Connections, but most just look up Mia Tracy. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, and I was invited to be on the podcast by my dear friend who helped me come to realize after many years that I was struggling with my own addiction, and so I'm hoping to give back to his show.
Well, thank you very much. I'm so glad you're here. So tell us maybe a little bit about your background and what connections you found, not just personally, but also kind of throughout your life and professionally, to addiction.
I actually want to back up and give you my own question, because one of my specialties is as a neuroaffective relational model therapist. And the way that NARM practitioners always lead sessions is with intention. So before this podcast, I sat and asked myself, what is my intention? And my intention is to hopefully reduce some of the shame around addiction and just come across as a real, genuine, authentic person doing this thing called being a human being, just like everybody else. So one thing I tell all of my clients when they first meet me is that, yes, I have a love for learning and I know a bunch, but you are the expert of you, and I am not, and I cannot possibly know you better than yourself. So yeah, I want to both hopefully reduce some shame for somebody out there listening, and also just, you know, really clarify that therapists are just in this game of life too.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for talking about that, because that is something that as a therapist myself, I really strive to just show up as another human being in a session. And that thing that you said is something that I actually bring up with my clients a fair bit, which is you are the world's foremost expert on you. So I have the questions, but you have the answers, and being able to come from that perspective. And I think that's really important, especially around addiction, because a lot of times, I will say historically, there's been a model where it's kind of like, okay, a little top down and like, look, you know, you're in denial. You don't know what's going on with you. You're delusional. I'm going to give you the facts and straighten you out and get your head on right. And even sometimes people will come into recovery fellowships. I know sometimes people will go into those and they'll hear things like, look, sit down, shut up, take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth. But as a therapist, I haven't found that's really a super effective way to deal with human beings at all,
right?
Especially people that are struggling, and being able to show more of that empathy and compassion for people is so important, especially around an issue where people may put forward a front of denial or a front of bravado, but often there's a lot of fear and shame behind it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you could talk about some of your experience with that.
Yeah. And I'm glad that you said top down, you know, and what you didn't say is bottom up, right? Top down being so heady and intellectual based, like most of us are, and bottom up being so body based and really just checking in with the intelligence of the body, right? Which is ultimately what led me to go into that first AA meeting, because God, did I fight it with my intelligence. But it's my body that really spoke and said, enough is enough. So back up and ask me that question one more time. I lost it.
No problem. So the basic question was around maybe talking about your experience working around the shame or stigma around addiction and helping people get through that, and what helped you get through it yourself.
So I grew up in a family of addiction. My father was an alcoholic, and my mother struggled with chronic pain and very high anxiety and probably overused medication. Maybe she had mild addiction. But to tell you the truth, I really didn't understand that as a child, and I don't think most children do. I just knew that something was off. My mom, I think, tried to do the best that she could, but she thought that the best thing to do would be to, in sixth grade, expose me to alcohol, like, you know, take the allure off of it. And so she would let me have Kahlua and cream or Zima, right? Which I might have had a fighting chance had she given me like some shitty box wine, but man, that Kahlua and that Zima was just, tasted so good. And I knew that the first time it touched my lips, I liked it. And I even liked the feeling, right? Body up again, the feeling in my body, because I think I'm wired to be a little bit more anxious. So that was the beginnings of alcoholism. By eighth grade, I would seek out friends that I knew their parents had open liquor cabinets, purposely make friends with those. Those were the best friends to have. We'd go over and raid the liquor cabinet in the middle of the night. Still, I didn't see anything wrong with that. We were just having fun. Then I want to kind of speed up through high school. I had a couple bad hangovers, and so I really lost the love for alcohol through those hangovers. I do not like feeling ill. And so picked up marijuana, and I definitely was addicted to marijuana for probably 6 years. I tried many, many times to stop use and could not. The only thing that finally ended my marijuana addiction was that I started working for the state and was just terrified that I was going to get tested. And that was enough to do it. Although I can even remember this one dream I still had of running through green fields of marijuana. So absolutely addicted to it. And then the alcohol addiction didn't really pick back up until I struggled with some postpartum depression. And at that time, my husband picked up on it, and he grew up with an alcoholic father who sought treatment and got help. And the best that my husband could do was basically sit me down and say, hey, listen, I'm not gonna tolerate this shit, right? But again, that was able to end the dance with Corona, Bud Light, any type of beer I could get my hands on. At that point in the addiction, it hadn't progressed to I'll drink anything. Again, I was still working for the state, but mostly I think that the addiction stayed at bay because of fear that my husband would leave me. So the addiction really started picking up in 2014 when I lost my first dog. And that is when I started drinking anything, even if I didn't like the taste. At that point, interestingly enough, I was able to go to my husband and say, hey, listen, I think I have a problem. And by this time, it was way later in our relationship, and he said, not my problem. You know, do something about it. We still had a strong, very much loving relationship, but he was not going to be my rescuer. He also, because I was so functional, he didn't see it as something that was getting in the way. So he trusted that I could figure my way out of it. So then we speed up to 1 year later. I had graduated my master's program, entered my first social work job, and I meet Casey.
Banana.
Banana. And even then, I think that I was struggling with some alcoholism, but more so than that, it was love addiction, but I did not even know that that was a thing until I walked into one of your classes. And when I heard everything, I was like, oh, fuck. This is the thing. And there is a theory that any type of substance use disorder is spawned from either food, sex, or love, because those are the biological needs, right?
That is a really big thing, and it's something I talk to my clients about as somebody who primarily identifies with sex and love addiction, even though I found out I need to stop drinking to stay sober in sex and love addiction. Currently, I'm dabbling in my fifth program. There's an old joke that if you're only in one recovery program, you're probably not being honest with yourself. But in all of that, one of the things I say to my clients is if you're dealing with stuff around food, sex, and love, those are like bottom line, not just biological needs, but biological imperatives. We are set up to do that. Whereas, yes, some people are born with a tolerance because their mother was using while they were pregnant, but people are not genetically set up where they need meth to survive, right? There's nothing in your brain that says, if you don't drink alcohol at some point in your life, you're not going to make it, let alone every day. But somebody around a food addiction, you got to take the tiger out of the cage at least three times a day. Sex and love. You can say, well, yes, I could live without sex, but there's still going to be a drive saying, yeah, but this is a good idea. You should be doing this. Otherwise, our species would be long gone. And when it comes to love, babies will die without it. I mean, we can't survive without a sense of connection.
Right.
And if we do, it's a very suffering sort of survival. So yeah, those are really difficult things. And often if my clients say, well, okay, I'm dealing with alcohol, especially working at a treatment center, just introducing people to this stuff. I'm dealing with alcohol, or I'm dealing with whatever issue brought me in. Now I'm a sex and love addict. I'm like, well, first of all, you probably have been all along. It's not that something new has appeared, you know, suddenly. It's that this has always been there underneath the other things. But I would say, look and see which one started first. And people say, well, okay, yeah, love addiction. I probably started by kindergarten. But when did you start using alcohol? Oh, that would be sixth grade. Okay, there's a long gap there where you're in one before the other one gets introduced. And frankly, a lot of people, alcohol or other drugs facilitate food addiction, sex and love addiction. You know, I worked with a client at one point who discovered that their drug use was actually about food, because when they were using, they could allow themselves to eat the way they wanted to.
Right.
And otherwise, they were super healthy and all this kind of stuff. But some part of them really didn't want to be super healthy because that meant they could not get the comfort and the rush that they wanted from the food.
Mm-hmm.
So I really appreciate you bringing that up.
Yeah, for sure. I've had many battles with addiction. I probably have all of the colors in the Crayola box, right? Probably a lot more work to do. Progress, not perfection, right?
So there you were. You're like, oh no, love addiction is a thing.
Yeah.
What happens from there?
So you said one other word, connection, which as a NARM practitioner, that is one of the stances that we're looking at, is how we connect and disconnect to ourself and others. And without alcohol, the disease had progressed so much that I was unable to connect to myself and others. And as a therapist, even with all of this going on, I had a high level of emotional intelligence. I could tell you in the minute whether I was feeling rejected or elated. So many nuanced emotions, right? But I couldn't tell you what made me feel that way. I couldn't get curious with it. So I did a little bit of work. I went to very few meetings of LAA, mostly were online. But again, just like the marijuana addiction, the consequences were so high in my life that it was easy for me to shed. I had over-disclosed to a previous boss, and that turned into sexual harassment. So it was easy for me to work myself out. Was not easy for me to work myself out of my relationship with alcohol. So in 2015, when I met you, I wasn't quite ready to even acknowledge that. I was still very much using that defense mechanism of denial and suppression. I think that I had an inkling of knowing, but I could still utilize some harm reduction methods, which I am not knocking on harm reduction. I think that managed use is possible with some. It was not with me. I tried very hard. I had some rules for myself, and sometimes I aced it. I was able to not bring alcohol in the house. I was able to not use if I was angry or sad. I was able to not drink more than two drinks. Until I wasn't. So I learned pretty quickly that harm reduction just would not work for me. But while I was working in the treatment centers, you know, I was so motivated by my clients and inspired by them and turned off when these folks come in and they're struggling. Like, you know, it literally seeps out of our pores and smells like ammonia. And so I was quite turned off, and I was also inspired at all of the recovery that I was seeing around me. So I could often go a month without drinking, sometimes 6 weeks, once 8 weeks, right? But then it was always back.
So, but who's counting, right?
Right. Yep.
Just pointing out that the average person who doesn't have a problem doesn't actually know the statistics like that.
Right, for sure. I just have a good memory, Casey.
Sure. For the important things.
Yep.
Well, that seems like a great place to take a break to hear from one of our sponsors. And then when we come back, we'll hear more of our interview.
New Year's is an exciting time. Hope feels tangible and possibilities endless. If you have a loved one who has decided to embrace sobriety in 2024, help them reach their goals. Introduce them to SoberLink, the only high-tech breathalyzer system that provides tangible, immediate proof of sobriety for true peace of mind. Scheduled tests improve routine. Device portability offers autonomy. Built-in facial recognition and tamper sensors prevent cheating. And instant test results help foster accountability and trust. Help your loved one commit to reinvention this year. Visit www.soberlink.com/family to learn more and receive a $50 off device promo code to share with someone you want to see succeed.
Welcome back. Let's get into more of that interview.
2020 is what really did me in, and 2020 is when I got really serious and admitted to myself, admitted to many friends, again, admitted to my husband, and my husband still took the stance of not my problem. And I think that's because I was so functional. Didn't have any DWIs. I wasn't coming home and acting irrational, fulfilling all of my obligations. In fact, my house was spotless when I was an alcoholic. That was my favorite thing to do. I joke in AA meetings that I was such a boring alcoholic, because oftentimes, you know, we go to these AA meetings and they tell all of these rebel stories and, you know, just wild fables. And I'm like, yeah, I cleaned my house. And when I knew I was getting really close to being an alcoholic, it's because I fell down the stairs with a handful of clothes. But I convinced myself it was because I was holding this massive handful of clothes, not that I was severely intoxicated. Right. So I was a really boring drunk. And Charlie kind of had one rule, which was really heartbreaking. If I had drank, he did not want to kiss me goodnight. because he could not stand the smell. And my husband and I are so very much in love with each other that was heartbreaking every time. Of course, as an alcoholic, I tried to cross those boundaries every time too. We learn so much about ourselves when we get sober. So 2020, I really started wrestling it. I could stay sober for months and then I would use. And finally in 2021, I was at a friend's house, indulging in a couple glasses of wine, watching shitty reality TV shows. My little girl was with me. She wanted to go home. And I told her, hey, listen, we can't go home. I can't drive. We're just, you know, gonna stay the night here. And she very much wanted to go home. And she was like, well, let me just call dad. Oh my God, I did not want her to call dad, right? At 11 p.m., you know, I knew that my husband would be irritated and that I would be in quote unquote trouble, right? And I did not want to feel that shame. I didn't want to take the responsibility and the accountability that, you know, I couldn't drive her home. And so I could feel like she was being a little sneaky. And so I saw her with my phone and I went in and I grabbed it from her and she started crying because she was calling her dad, rightfully so, she should have. And, you know, I was like, I told you that we were staying here. And she screamed at the top of her lungs, I hate you.
If I can ask, that moment is so important. Mm. What hits emotionally even today when you talk about that?
Yeah. It's a great question, and I appreciate you pulling me into my emotions. I hate crying, though. just that I was so blind that I couldn't see that. I couldn't see how much it was affecting her. And also, you know, admiration that she had the healthy protest, aka anger, to say that to me, right? And she's only 10 years old. So I said, okay, call daddy. And Charlie came and picked her up and I stayed the night. And the next morning I did the walk of shame into the house. You know, and the cool thing is that they just laughed and loved me. I'm very lucky in that way. I know most families don't have that experience. And I looked at him and I said, you know, I'm done. And he laughed and he said, okay. Which he did every time, right? And every time it hurt that he said that, but there was probably a part of me that knew that he was right. But what I did differently in that moment is I contacted a person that was in recovery that I used to work with and wasn't all that close to her. And she certainly knew me as this esteemed therapist that apparently had it all together. And I reached out to her and I told her, hey, I need a sponsor. Can you be my sponsor? And she said, well, you know, I can't, but I've got the perfect person for you. And there was a part of me that did not want to reach out to some stranger that I didn't know because, you know, by the way, only a therapist can really understand another therapist, right? And I reached out to this lady that has 30-something years of sobriety and told her what was going on. And she encouraged me to go to a meeting, which was not happening. We live in a very rural community, and I was not about to walk into a meeting as a therapist, run into clients that I had previously worked with and such. So it took me about a month, and I was already with my own therapist. I very much believe being a therapist, we need to stay in therapy ourselves. I was explaining the difficulty of going to AA, but knowing that I needed some type of accountability and community. And she said, so because you're a therapist, you're unworthy of seeking help. And those words just landed. So I said, yeah, you know, you're right. And furthermore, going back to, she's also a NARM practitioner, and we lead with that genuine relationship. So going back to the beginning of this podcast, I have never told a client, hey, I got all my shit together, right? I remember walking into my first AA meeting, and I was dripping in sweat. My heart was racing out of my chest. I know I'm going to run into a client. I know it's going to happen. I know it. I know all of the recovery centers out here. They bring van loads of people in. I know it's going to happen. And sure as shit, it fucking happened. And I was like, thanks, God. Can't even let me off the hook once, right?
Get it out of the way.
Yep. Get it. Yeah, that happened. I sat in that meeting and there was, again, you know, a part of me, I know what you're talking about because you work with internal family systems. And so there was this part of me that was like, don't raise your hand. You know, maybe everybody will just think that you're just here to gain some knowledge about alcoholism and addiction. But the motivation was so strong to change at that point. I was so tired of looking at myself in the mirror. You know, as a side note, I work out a bunch. Every morning I went to the gym, I was like, why are you even doing this? You're just going to go home and drink two bottles of wine tonight, right? So much shame and self-disgust because I'm so healthy, and it was just in direct opposition to who I am.
Well, that's such an important thing to talk about because you're hitting on several different levels. The idea of shame in that my actions don't match up with my values. Right. And that, I think, is the psychological mechanism underneath the old idea of hitting bottom. We say, oh, the person's got to hit bottom. Well, they've gone to jail three times. How can they not have hit bottom? You know, this happened, that happened. From the outside, there's no way to tell. But on the inside, there is some moment that people have when they hit bottom, which is, I just am not going to live this way anymore. I can't stand the gulf in between my actions and who I am as a person. Mm-hmm. And that speaks to just my basic orientation as a therapist and just as a human being at this point, that everybody at their core is a really good person. And everything else is just all this masking and defense stuff that comes out of fear. And that's a natural part of the brain too, but I don't think of that as being the core of who we are, because I keep having the miraculous experience, whether it's in the rooms of recovery, therapy, treatment, whatever, where I get to see people as they shed their fears, they just relax into being like kind, loving people. Mm-hmm. And so knowing that that kind, loving person is inside somebody while they are doing things that may be profoundly antisocial or just go so strongly against their values. And I've seen that even in reading about people and personality disorder, which has a lot of overlap with addiction, but they weren't talking about their addiction. They were talking about something completely different, theoretically. And yet there are the parallels where they said, like, one day I just woke up and I said, I can't live like this anymore. What do I need to do to get better? And from that point, I was willing to do whatever it took. Right. And that's such a profound moment for people. And it's not something that can be manufactured.
No, it's not. Or forced, right?
And then there's the additional layer that you're talking about, that as a helping professional, how do I show up? You know, how do I show up and say, like, I'm going to go, like you said, I'm going to go to a meeting, I'm going to run into a client who maybe I had at a treatment center a year ago, they have a year sober, I'm at my first meeting. Mm-hmm. Like, how do I step through all of that? But what I hear is underneath that, the motivation is that I just can't keep going like this anymore.
Right.
So I am willing to face whatever fear, whatever it takes. And since this is a program that a lot of family members listen to, I know a lot of family members, if your loved one is struggling, it'd be tempting to say, well, how do I get them to get to that point? But I'm going to say to the family members, first of all, you can't. That's impossible. But second of all, maybe looking and seeing what's going on within you, where do you get to a point where you say, I'm not going to keep going like this anymore, where you either can set boundaries, stop enabling, or ideally, I'm going to say, get into your own recovery.
Right.
Find where that is for you.
Yeah.
So you hit that point and you were willing to do whatever it took. You showed up. There you were. There was your fear right in front of you. You faced it anyway.
Yeah. My husband would never get into his own recovery. But again, I don't even know that he really needed it because he was so hands off and he had really firm boundaries. He would never buy me alcohol and he would not drink with me. And again, you know, we already talked about the goodnight kissing thing. That wasn't happening either. So yeah, he had a lot of firm boundaries. And I had a lot of advantage as a therapist, which I am so grateful for. So I knew what was going on in me and I knew what I needed to do, which is totally be honest. So again, there was a part of me that wanted to not raise my hand and say, you know, I'm Mia, I'm a recovering alcoholic. And I will talk about the way that I stated that hopefully later on. But I knew I needed to. And I started sharing it with everyone. anytime I could, I'm a recovering alcoholic, I'm a recovering alcoholic, because I needed that identity to keep me accountable. So yes, I did seek recovery through AA, went to as many meetings as possible, stayed in close contact with my sponsor. Yeah, I'm at a little bit of an ending point. I mean, I've got a little bit more story, but do you have any more questions here?
Well, I'm going to say in a way it's an ending point, but it's also a beginning point. Right. It's like there's the jumping off point for you as a therapist to embrace that identity as being a therapist, being in recovery. And you talked at the very top of this recording about the idea of, you know, hopefully this will help someone. I think this potentially helps a lot of people. But particularly if there's anyone else out there in the helping professions, many of us are people who grew up, you know, wanting to save somebody. You know, maybe we had the parent who struggled with whatever issue, mental health, including addiction. And it's like, well, I couldn't save them. Maybe I can save all these other people. And it's like, at one point, I have to raise my hand and say, yeah, but I need the help. And a lot of people who are in a helping role may have trouble accepting help.
Mm-hmm.
So my hope is that anyone out there listening who might find themselves in that position, whether they're a family member who's just trying to save family members, maybe you're working as an EMT, maybe you're a military medic, whatever it is, obviously, if you're a therapist, that you can find the courage to reach out for your own help, perhaps from listening to this.
And in those AA meetings, I cannot tell you how often people let me know, because again, just out of the gates, I would even acknowledge, hey, I'm a therapist and I'm struggling here. And I did not feel an ounce of judgment. Maybe I was judged, I don't know, but—
That's their problem.
Yeah, it was totally their problem. I will say another important thing that has come up is that I have lapsed or relapsed, whatever you want to call it. I know that there's two schools of thought around that. My school of thought is that it's a lapse, because I think a relapse is returning back to old behavior patterns. So I picked up one day and put it down, got back on track, and I really had to check in with some shame around that. But what was so helpful is that idea that this is a disease, and if somebody relapsed with cancer, right, we would not shame them. We would just support them, and we would be compassionate for ourselves, right? Maybe sad for ourselves, but we wouldn't shame ourselves.
Absolutely. And I think people can wrap their head around that with things like diabetes or heart disease. It's harder with some mental illnesses. But even then, if you had a relative who you knew, say, had schizophrenia, they didn't choose to hear voices or have the delusions that were happening. If they were able to stabilize for a while and then the voices started coming back, hopefully we wouldn't think, well, I guess you didn't want it badly enough. And yet you'll hear that language around addiction. I'll hear people say things like, well, you know, I guess you didn't really get step one. But even with other mental health conditions, we wouldn't typically say that. We might, as a loved one, feel like, oh, man. But especially if someone just, like you said, kind of isn't going all the way back down to the bottom of the pool. Maybe they go down, touch it, come right back up and catch their breath again and get back on with their recovery, which, frankly, I've done a number of times. I'll tell people all the time, I've got 24 years in recovery. I have 18 of those continuously sober. So there's 7 years in there where I would put together 6 months, year. I think when I went a year and a half one time. And then I'd have to touch the stove again and see, is it still hot? Mm-hmm. It is. But the real heat in that wasn't outside consequences. I don't think in any of those I had outside consequences. It was always the internal, like, ah, this is not who I want to be.
Right.
And I think at a certain point after 7 years of that, I hit another kind of bottom within the program. Of just saying, like, I am tired of seeing other people put together sober time. That was partly my pride, and I like to think that I don't have any character defects my higher power can't put to good use. So
yep.
I was able to use my pride. You know, that kept me alive as a parent when my daughter was just 2 years old and I first got into recovery, because I knew we had done a pretty good job up till then. And I thought, because when I first got sober, I thought I'd rather die.
Mm-hmm.
So I literally was planning suicide. And I knew that nobody's life story starts out really well, where it's like, my dad killed himself when I was two. Mm-hmm. So that pride and love for her kind of pulled me through the initial withdrawal. But later, it wasn't anybody else. It wasn't thought of, what are people going to think, or how do people react, or how will they look at me? It was me. Like you said, looking in the mirror, just going, yeah, this is not how I want to see myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so based on that, I'd say I hit maybe a deeper bottom and said, okay, now I know something that I didn't know before and that I need to know. And I would say, honestly, that's probably where my spirituality took off within the program.
Right.
Let's take a quick break there to hear from one of our sponsors. And when we come back, we'll have the rest of our interview. Among our sponsors, the most important one is you. We are so grateful for your support in our mission to help people with addiction and their families find recovery. Here are some ways you can help. I have a website at caseyauthor.com where you can find all the various ways I am working to spread a message of hope for anyone struggling with addiction and anyone who loves them. There you can find videos, interviews I've given on other people's podcasts, information on my books, Realistic Hope, The Family Survival Guide for Facing Alcoholism and Other Addictions, Spirituality for People Who Hate Spirituality, and my newest book, Mommy's Getting Sober, a children's book that also includes a guide for caregivers on how to talk to kids about addiction. All three are available on Amazon and other retailers as both paperback and ebook. If you have read them, please tell a friend or anyone you think might be helped by their message. There's also a link to help support us on Patreon.com. Your subscriptions help make all this possible. If you'd like to become a subscriber, visit Patreon.com and look up Addiction and the Family. Thanks again. We couldn't do this without you. All right, let's finish up our interview with Mia Tracy. I would love it if you would talk a little bit about all of the things that you have gotten from recovery in your life. Because so often we can tell the story, it's like, this terrible thing happened, that thing happened, this thing happened, and then I got in recovery, and it's like, oh, well, we're about out of time. All right, folks, it's been great. So maybe talk a little bit about what recovery has done for you, both as just an individual and maybe also as a therapist.
Yeah, you talked about pride, and I've talked about shame. And one of the things that I love teaching people is that there is no bad emotion. We just want to live from a conscious place and know, again, what is this emotion about? Why are we using it? Are we using it appropriately? And I certainly wasn't using pride and shame appropriately. And yes, shame can be a good emotion. You know, we learn through all sorts of ways. We learn through embarrassment and shame. But again, we don't want to overuse it. We don't want it to keep us stuck. So that's one of the things that I gained from recovery is learning how to appropriately use my emotions. During my recovery, you know, one of the biggest hurdles was that I was diagnosed with some very aggressive pre-cancer. And I can tell you that had I been drinking, I absolutely, upon that diagnosis, would have probably had a binge of more than a month. But it was so cool to be able to walk through that journey and those surgeries with just such peace and serenity and surrender that no matter what, everything was going to be okay. And to really not only know the emotion that I was feeling, but feel the emotion and gain the resilience, right? That would be one of the biggest things that I think that I gained from recovery is resilience.
That is really beautiful.
Yeah.
You talked about your husband's family history, your personal history. How have you talked to the kids about addiction in your family?
My kiddos very much knew where I worked. So I would always talk to them about, you know, I'm working in addiction treatment centers. These people are struggling. And when they saw me go through my own struggle, they got a little bit more curious about why I wasn't immune from addiction if I was a therapist. So I got to have a lovely talk about we're all in this game of life. I want to say something here, which is a way that I talk to my children, and it was a little bit more elementary, but one of the things that brought me to finally seek help was this idea that we're born addicted. Every single one of us is addicted to something, whether it is an addiction of abundance and indulgence or an addiction of restriction, counting calories obsessively, being too frugal with our money, being overindulgent in food, in shopping, in gambling, in substances, even an addiction to hypochondria and our health. or anxiety, right? So this theory that we are all born addicted. I'm going to say the G-O-D word, whatever that means to you. I'm a very spiritual person, not a religious person. But that, you know, source, creator, naturally instilled this in us so that we could hit our knees and be humble, right? And say, I do not have this shit. I am not God. I do not have it figured out. And to keep us humble, to keep us learning, to keep us growing, to give us a little challenge. I love telling clients pain is the portal to growth. Let this conflict help you be resilient. So the theory that we are all addicted to something also reduced my shame.
Very cool. As you may know, I'm a little passionate about how we talk to kids about addiction and being able to get them involved in the conversation. And especially I know with my own daughter, for instance, talking to my daughter and just saying, look, this runs in the family. Here's our history, genetically, within the family culture. These are things to look out for, and here's where you find help. And I think a lot of times that's about as much as we can do. Mm. Like, we can't spare our kids from right. genetic destiny or anything like that. But we can say, here's where you find solution. And we can be honest with them.
Right.
Sounds like you found some opportunities to do that with your own kids.
Right. And it's education, right? Again, I said that I had an advantage because of my education. So just educating them that this is what to look for.
Yeah. What to look for, what to do about it.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll move towards wrapping up. I guess I'll ask, especially knowing that this is a program that a lot of family members listen to, is there anything else that you want to say to the folks out there?
I knew you were going to ask me this question, and so funny story, when I was working at a treatment center and they came up to me and they said, yeah, you know, we want you to do family day. And I was like, nope, but I got the right therapist for you. And then I called Casey and I said, hey, Case, I got a job for you. I know you're in love with your current job, but this one's better. Because I did not want to teach family day. Maybe I still have work to do around that. That's probably what that resistance is. If you could see me right now, I went all of a sudden from a relaxed position to an arm folded position. Nope, not happening. Man, I'm glad that my husband was so gracious in the way that he was hands off. Because even though I came to him and said, hey, listen, this is what's going on, I believe if he were to put any type of pressure on me, I would have totally rebelled. So I guess that would be my advice to families, is to do your best to set those boundaries, but set them with love, right? And of course, there are things going on in families where there's too much chaos and somebody might have to leave, and that would be a boundary too, right? But at least initially, you know, thinking about just the theory of least restrictive, start out with compassion and small boundaries and love. And if it gets too chaotic, then of course, you know, you might have to make that decision to leave. But controlling it will only make you internally chaotic too.
Absolutely. And pointing out, at least, you know, my take on boundaries is that they're not telling other people what to do. They're telling them what we're going to do.
Exactly.
So for instance, yes, if you're drinking, I'm not going to be intimate with you.
Yep.
I've known a number of people that kept that boundary, and that within itself, again, not saying, hey, if I do this, then they'll get sober, but just saying, no, I'm standing up for my safety and my values. That to me is where boundaries are supposed to go, is to protect our safety and our values. All the little stuff, you know, what do we watch on TV? I don't need to worry about that. That's not like where I set a boundary, but boundaries are saying, hey, if you're going to do this, I'm going to do that, which doesn't always have to be negative. Mm-hmm. It could be, you know, you could phrase the same thing as, hey, if you're sober, then I'd love to be close with you tonight.
Right.
Yeah. You know, different phrasing, but the same boundary, and being able to say like, okay, I can recognize I'm standing up for something that's important to me, rather than if I say the right magic words, I can get somebody else sober, because nobody's told me what those magic words are yet.
Right. Yeah. Beautifully stated, Casey.
Thank you. Well, what a pleasure to have you on after all this time. I'm really glad we were able to have you come out.
Yeah, thank you.
And maybe we'll have you back sometime.
Alrighty, sounds good.
Thanks so much. And that's our interview with Mia Tracy. You can contact her at inmindconnections.com. Thanks for being with us through another episode of Addiction and the Family. As they say in many recovery meetings, take what you liked and leave the rest. Go out and explore the possibilities for recovery in your life,
and give your loved ones the space and dignity to make their own choices. If you liked this podcast, please subscribe. It means a lot to us. If you know anyone else who could use what we have to offer, please tell them about Addiction to the Family. If you have comments about this podcast, have a question you'd like to answer on the show, or want to contribute your voice, or just want to say hi, you can write to us at addictionandthefamily@gmail.com. We're also happy to be your friend on Facebook, and we can be found tweeting on Twitter.
Addiction and the Family is produced, written, and engineered by Kira and Casey Arriaga, with music by Casey.